It really hit hard on me that when I started my final year of uni, that I wanted to be able to actually reflect and think that uni was a great time. And at that point, it was not. It was just me just hitting the books and really not enjoying it. I took the plunge and the risk of starting TEDxUWA purely for my selfish benefit, because I wanted a kick out of it, but also because there seemed to be a huge opportunity that we can tap into.
You could have just joined the Quidditch team, you know, right?
Yeah, I could have. I could have just, you know, or the wine tasting club or something like that, you know.
Welcome back to Herstory. This series gets stuck into the stories of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. My name's Taylor Strano. I'm with you each week as we meet some of the trailblazing women who've called WA their home. For episode 3, we meet one of the youngest inductees to the Hall of Fame, Theodosia Koniawan, or Thea, as she's known to her friends and family, entered the Hall of Fame in 2022 at just 25 years old. She's been recognised for her lifetime of engaging with the community and carving out spaces for everyone to feel welcome. And while it might only be 2.5 decades, Thea has made light work of her contributions, including establishing TEDxUWA while studying at the University of Western Australia and co-founding the Willy Wagtail Project, encouraging children to tackle the big issues like global waste and climate change. It's Season 2, Episode 3 of Herstory with Theodosia Koniawan. This is Her Story.
My name's Thea Koniawan. I'm an engineer and consultant working in the city.
Let's start with childhood.
Yep.
Where did you grow up? Predominantly Perth or Indonesia?
I would say a mix of both, actually. It was literally like experiencing being straddled on two sides of the fence, but also on the fence at the same time.
Okay.
So I grew up, was born in Jakarta, moved to Perth with my family when I was 7. And because of Dad's work, did a lot of travelling back and forth during school holidays and the like, and that resulted to me also living in there for about 3 more years towards the finishing of my high school. So, I would say it's sort of an equal measure, a bit of both, because after high school for about sort of 3-4 years in Jakarta, moved back here for uni and then now work. So it's literally just, straddling, I would say. And reflecting back now, I would say it's an equal measure of both of equal times, yeah.
And so you can't play favourites. Do you have a favourite?
I actually don't. No, it's really difficult because this question pops up quite often and I've just drawn up many a pros and cons list and I think they all measure up pretty equally, yeah. But I would say it wouldn't be a favourite, but my go-to or where I call home is where my family is, which is Perth.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you moved to Australia at the age of 7. What prompted your family to make that move?
I would say it's probably because of me. Jakarta is a huge metropolis, overly populated. The food is great, everything's cheap, but the downside is pollution's not great there and traffic is not great there. And I think for a young family raising, young kids, it's just not a very holistic environment to raise, a young family essentially. So my parents were always looking for options of potentially moving to find environments that would be a lot more freeing and liberating for young kids to just run around and play and enjoy. So that was probably the main prompt behind it, yeah.
Do you remember the conversation your parents were saying, they sat you down and were like, we're going to move to a different country? Is that kind of how it happened?
Pretty much. I think they were thinking of it behind the scenes and then they would just like make the decision, then they'll announce the decision to us. At that time, I was obviously 7. I had a younger sister who was 3. So I don't really recall the conversation in full, but I know that Mum lived in Perth before she did her master's here. So I think we were all just relying on her experience based on what this Perth was. I think at that time we were all like, if Mum and Dad think it's a good idea, then we'll go with them because wherever the family is, that's where home is.
Yeah, you're also 7. You don't get to make that choice.
I don't think so, no.
So you came here and then I imagine you're in school. Do you remember what your first impressions of Western Australian life and school life was?
I actually distinctly remember when we arrived at Perth Airport with all of our many, many luggage. I was so used to drinking chocolate milk when I was little. Like, I just absolutely loved milk as a little girl with, you know, just building up my bones and my calcium. And for some reason, after-school pastime was just me going to the fridge and getting a glass of milk. So I was like, okay, I'm strangely really craving milk the moment I landed. So Mum got me a Master's chocolate milk box, and I was like, oh, perfect. And then I distinctly remember trying it, and obviously back in Indo, I was just so used to the heavily sugared and sort of more Asian-flavoured chocolate milk that I wasn't disgusted per se, but I was just really shocked at the different flavour profile, and it was just a lot more muted because obviously it wasn't loaded with sugar. But I think that was my very first experience of Australian culture, because like, oh, you know, maybe they do everything differently here and what is it going to be? And I think just as I was downing that milk, it just dawned on me that we're in a completely new environment. There's going to be new things I need to adjust to, and I was both excited but also very nervous at that prospect.
It's too late to go back now.
Yeah, I know. I was like drinking my milk. I was like chugging my milk down.
Your parents, you've talked about them a little bit already, but they're both from the philanthropic background. Is that where your inspiration comes from where you've gone with your work?
Yeah, my parents really brought us up to be very loving people, you know, that love the environment, love your neighbours and love each other kind of mindset. But ultimately, sorry, I said that the wrong way around. It's supposed to be love oneself, then love your neighbours, then love the environment, and it's sort of like a big life cycle from there. And they really instilled in me and my sisters values of working hard and building oneself, but using the skills and the knowledge that you've built to share for the benefit of others and for a collective community benefit. So, yeah, I think growing up, I really valued that as a really strong virtue that, you know, we all should have, whether we decide to be prime ministers or big leaders or just being, you know, your daily pizza delivery girl or something like that. You know, I think everyone has a role to play in this big ecosystem, and big or small, it's still an impact. And I really love the grassroots movement because from little things, big things do grow. And I think it's just a combination of those values plus the fact that I am the eldest. So now I have two younger sisters. And then so my middle sister was born when I was 4. So I think I only had about 3.5 years of purely living on my own, and that was fantastic. From a very young age, I was already sort of, you know, mentally conditioned in a way, in a good way, to sort of realise that I have other people to look out for as well.
You got to start sharing the chocolate milk.
But luckily, she was a bit more of a strawberry or vanilla milk fan, so I didn't really have to share my chocolate milk.
Talk me through your schooling years. Let's jump to high school. What were you like in high school? What was high school Thea all about?
High school Thea was really just still trying to find her identity. I think I owe a lot to coming to Perth when I was quite young. I look back and I have a lot of friends from uni who came to Perth in high school and found their experience very different to mine. Then again, everyone's experiences are different. But I think there was a huge value in coming to Perth when I was in year two and having that adjustment process a lot earlier. So I think high school Thea was less adjusting to the culture of Australiana because she already got that crash course, thankfully, in her primary school years. But I think high school Thea was also trying to be more of a, okay, I was still struggling, I think, at that time with my identity in the sense that when I'm here in Australia, I sound like this and I've been able to cultivate my, what I would think, an Australian accent thanks to moving here from such a young age. But I still ultimately look a little bit different compared to my peers. A lot of my, you know, classmates were predominantly, you know, European or Caucasian in background and in look. And so sometimes I felt, well, I sound Australian and I feel Australian, but I'm also maybe not 100% Australian. And then whenever I would go back to Indonesia to catch up with family or friends there, I also felt that I wasn't fully Indonesian either. Even though I could speak the language still, I can kind of remember, you know, the amazing food and things like that there. There was still that sense of identity crisis in both places. So I kind of felt like a fish out of water.
That's a lot for a teenager to process.
Plus all the assignments and all the tests that I have to do.
And like, you know, just regular teenage fodder. Like, who am I? What am I going to wear to the year 12 ball? I need to get my driver's license. Mm-hmm. How do you process all of those things? And like you said at the beginning, straddling these two different worlds at the same time.
I think I was very grateful that I had my family around and they are literally my rock. So we all moved here as a family, my parents and my siblings. We don't have any other extended relatives here, which can be a bit difficult, but I think very grateful that we still have each other. So I would come back home with, you know, both good and not so good news. And they would always be, in a way, my neutralizer to help give me advice whenever I feel like I'm, you know, down in the dumps, or if I feel that I'm confused in some way, things like that. You know, I had my sisters who were also, in a way, you know, sharing their own struggles, but being in a similar boat, but also my parents who, both of them, you know, in their own individual lives, they also studied abroad. So they also felt that out of place experience in their own generation. But to be able to get advice from them and sort of exchange lessons learnt has been really helpful.
I feel like high school, as far as I can see, is the place where you really started to become, and I mean this in the best way, an overachiever. We'll talk all about the work and your awards and accolades shortly. But I can see from high school you were a part of many extracurriculars. It's also where things like the environmental committee that you were a part of started to come to the forefront. Just talk us through briefly some of the clubs maybe that you were involved in.
So Millennium Kids, which is the youth empowered and run environmental advocacy that you're probably referring to, I got a first taste of them back in year five. So I was very fortunate that basically I owe a lot of who I am today and the values that I have today to teachers. And I think I can't stress enough the importance of teachers in our community, good teachers who are really passionate in not only teaching the curriculum, but really empowering and inspiring their students to pursue whatever interests that they have. So I had this one fantastic teacher, shout out Miss Beecher, who was just such a gun in, you know, not only teaching us what needs to be taught, but allowing us to spread our wings and really find our niche or find what really sort of, you know, makes us curious to find out more about the world. And one of her biggest, you know, focus areas is the environment and sustainability. So she connected with Millennium Kids and they came to our school for a climate change workshop, just allowing young people to really think and brainstorm ideas of a world without waste and identifying, you know, problem areas or focus areas and thinking about solutions that could address that. So I got to experience that workshop. Again, this is like sort of year five, so still finding my feet. I just sort of identified a little easy problem that had a little easy solution. And I was like, well, it's just small, but, you know, nothing grand scale, nothing, you know, Nobel Prize winning or anything. But that's just my little offering to the table. And I think I was very fortunate that Katrina from Millennium Kids, she's the CEO, was able to still find value in that little offering of mine. And she empowered me, along with my teacher, Miss Beecher, and others, to just really develop on that idea and eventually pitch it to our principal. So it was simply just making an e-newsletter system. So at the end of every week, so every Friday, each student would get, at that time, a paper newsletter to give to their parents. It was just meant to recap what happened in the week. Sometimes families would get duplicates or even triplicates because of the siblings in the school. So I just thought, well, if we hypothetically got all those newsletters and asked the students to put it in like a collection bin, I wanted to see how much paper we're actually wasting in a week, and not to mention other potential wastage as well, not just those newsletters. So just a simple act of switching it into an e-newsletter system I thought was really easy and trivial. That is like, oh, it's not really worth anything, like the school can just do it, you know. But it's interesting, and again, reinforcing those from little things, big things grow, because sometimes it's the little and the really quick and easy solutions that might get overlooked, actually. So it was a great lesson early on in expanding my confidence, I think, but also the way that I face problem solving, because sometimes we don't always need the big, grand movers and shakers style of solutions. We can start small and build from there.
One of the things that I really wanted to talk to you about, Thea, is you're one of the youngest people who have been inducted to the West Australian Women's Hall of Fame. In the first season of this podcast, we spoke to the youngest inductee, Drazana Levetsky-Gray. You're not too far behind that. You're only 25 years of age this year and you were inducted in 2022. What do you have to say to people? There's often this sort of rhetoric or idea that young people have all these great, big, brilliant, world-changing ideas but can't act upon it. You're living proof that is the case at like 11 years old, let alone what you've achieved since you were in year five. What do you have to say to people who maybe reject this idea of children and young people having radical change?
I think it was really vital that I got to experience an organisation like Millennium Kids that was just so, at the time, forward-thinking in really letting the kids have a say and really letting the kids be heard. Because without Millennium Kids, without their mentorship, I wasn't able to build my confidence to ultimately pitch to my principal, and later discovered that Millennium Kids also provides opportunities for more young people to be heard by mayors and local council members and even federal government or professional pitch nights. And it's all because of what I call the big kids, or the kids at heart, who have those professional networks to open the pathway to sort of introduce those kids to such opportunities. So it's a huge testament to the mentors, and I think I would not be here without people who have taken the time, you know, or investing their time in supporting me, because I think that's really important. I still feel a little bit of that, you know, I'm supposed to really, really just like kill it, but I still feel to this day the whole imposter syndrome that, you know, especially the work that I do, a lot of it is very team-based, it's very community-based, and that's who I am. I'm more of a behind-the-scenes kind of person than a, you know, being singled out and being on a podcast guest kind of person. And being inducted is a huge honour, but it is also a huge testament that I think I'm just here to represent the amazing other young people that I work with and other amazing people who make part of the movement that I really support. And I think it is vital that we continue to support our young people, because they are going to be our future leaders, our future prime ministers. And if they don't get the right holistic and well-rounded support, then, you know, we're not going to sort of break that vicious cycle of non-empathetic leaders or, you know, non-compassionate leaders. And we need more of that, and we need more free thinkers and more radical movers and shakers to build a better tomorrow.
Let's jump into time at university. You studied at UWA. What were you studying while you were there?
I'm studying engineering, trying to get into a chemical engineering degree. Yeah.
And is that what you ended up graduating with?
So the way it's structured, I graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Engineering Science. The next step was to do a Master's to really officiate that, yeah.
How do you feel about your time at university? Was study like a natural flow-on from high school and studying in childhood?
I think from high school to uni was really the big jump of, oh, like, this is now something that I need to fully take charge on. I think I was very much at that mindset where, you know, most people who are 18, they kind of really go off and they become their own adults. I mean, legally as well, they become their own adults here in Australia. And this is when you can really take full control and also full responsibility, because if you miss that one lecture, you know, you got to just catch up. Like, your parents are not going to be there anymore to safeguard you. But the interesting part was, I think because of the nature of me moving between Indo and Australia for high school and uni, I actually started uni at 16. So it was more because the academic calendar is different, but also kind of because I skipped a grade, but that's a long story. But long story short, I started uni at 16, and that was kind of daunting because I think I was still in very much a high school Thea, you know, mid, like, really smack bang in her teens, puberty, all that jazz. Plus, I was moving back to Australia, another cultural reset, and uni, like, a completely different ball game. Uni, it just blew up in my face a little bit because it was so big and everything was just so daunting. I think I remember going to O-Day, which is where, like, that pre-first day where you get to see all the different clubs that you can join, all that kind of stuff, and everyone seemed as if they knew each other and all that. So I think it was a little bit difficult, to be honest, finding my feet at uni. Granted that I did just arrive back from finishing high school in Indonesia. while I did have friends from my Perth high school at the same uni as me, they haven't started uni yet because I started a year or so earlier than them. So I kind of couldn't look out for them for support. And I ended up just having to re-find my feet again and find a new set of friends and community groups. Yeah.
Let's address the obvious as well. You can't go to the uni pub.
Yeah, I can't go to go to the tab or anything like that. Like, I'm a big quiz night nerd. Like, I love a good trivia night or a pub quiz kind of thing. I can't go to them because at the time I was just too scared to sneak in a fake ID or just try to pretend to look like I was 18. Yeah, so I missed out that portion of, you know, uni lifestyle gloriousness. But I think I managed to compensate that with other things, yeah.
Well, one of those things, and maybe one of the things that you're most well known for, is starting up TEDx UWA. Talk to me a little bit about how that process came about. Is it something that you were always wanting to do?
So since high school, I discovered what TED Talks was or is, and I love the nature of TED Talks because, one, I was already like a huge YouTube wormhole nerd. I could just spend the whole day just watching all these content, good and bad, I guess. But I loved how multidisciplinary TED Talks are. So for someone who's studying very heavily technical in the sciences since high school up until uni, I'm a really big fan of the whole left and right brain balance. So while I was heavily technical, I do have a creative side and I play musical instruments and I like to bake and things like that. So I found joy in escaping my reality in a way by going to TED Talks and watching the completest, randomest things from like astrophysics all the way to the benefits of procrastinating as I was procrastinating. It's a really good TED Talk, by the way. And I thought my relationship with TED was just simply a passive, you know, consumer in a way of all their content. It was only when I went on exchange that I discovered that TED does hand out, you have to apply, but they give out free licenses for people to run a TED style event in their local community. I think at that time, TEDx Perth did exist. They were fantastic. They've been around, I think, for already sort of 5 or 6 years. But for someone who's sort of a young person like myself, who's a huge fan of TED Talks, wanting to really get the full live experience, unfortunately, the tickets were really out of my budget. It was really not accessible for younger people. And when I did eventually go, I noticed that majority of the audiences were, you know, income earning professionals and the like. But I believe that it's young people that need to have more of the right to experience these kinds of things. And I also have so many other friends who loved watching TED Talks like myself and wanting to get that live experience too. So it only makes sense to kind of start one up. So yeah, during my exchange, got to experience being part of a TEDx university style organization, learned, you know, what good looks like, how it could be run and organized, and basically took that model to sort of pilot one at UWA.
What year did this start in?
It started in 2016, which was actually my final year of my undergrad studying an engineering degree. I would not recommend anybody starting a club in their final year of uni. It was very taxing. You know, it got distracting, and let's be real, my grades did slip. But I think on a more personal note, because like we were discussing earlier, I was still really struggling to find my identity at uni. And maybe it was because I started when so young and wasn't really going to the tabs and socializing that much in my first and second year that I ended up becoming your typical bookworm. And I was just purely going to uni to attend lectures and studying and then going home. So I really didn't have that vibrant university experience that I would like to look back fondly on. It really hit hard on me that when I started my final year of uni, that I wanted to be able to actually reflect and think that uni was a great time. And at that point, it was not. It was just me just hitting the books and really not enjoying it. I took the plunge and the risk of starting TEDx UWA purely for my selfish benefit because I wanted a kick out of it, but also because there seemed to be a huge opportunity that we can tap into.
You could have just joined the Quidditch team, you know, right?
Yeah, I could have. I could have just, you know, or the wine tasting club or something like that, you know.
But we'll add event organiser to your resume now as well. Talk us through the very first TEDx UWA. Who did you have speaking? What was it like leading up to the event?
Yeah, so the first TEDx UWA conference was on the 26th of October. November 2016. I kind of remember it fondly, but also hazily. It was at a really, like, at that time, quite new theatre and auditorium venue. We were, like, kind of the first. It was, like, also in the medical area of UWA at the Harry Perkins Institute. And I think we were one of very few non-medical organisations to be running an event there at that time. So it's very new. We're very pioneering at that time. Leading up to it was pretty intense, but luckily we ran a smaller scale event back in like June, July, as in a way a pilot, which was very strategic of us to be doing that. So we were able to have a test run in a smaller scale, patch test it, get our audience growing.
Soft launch.
Yeah, that's the word. There we go. So that was fantastic to build our brand and then to culminate it to the big one at the end of the year, which was really good. But it was a hectic process because it was an interesting challenge that I embraced fully because I was just so energetic and I had so much time in my hands at the time. Because we need to know that in that club, in our first year, I was the only one that had the experience of being part of a TEDx organization before. The rest of my team did not, and they fully relied on, I guess, my perspective, which is not always a good thing, you know, like having a one-sided perspective can be quite difficult in generating some great new ideas. So they were purely relying on what I knew, plus, I guess, what they could find on the internet or getting resources from the TED team in New York. They were like, okay, like, how should we do this? How should we structure it this way? How should we even reach out to third parties for sponsorships or partnerships or even, you know, getting speakers in? So I think it was an exciting time. And when we essentially launched the event, we just put it up on Facebook, did not think about it. And literally overnight, it blew up. We had like 6,000 people clicking interested, already 2,000 people claiming they're going when the venue only could fit 120 people. And I think they were just excited, which was exciting because the TEDx community at the time was still quite small, especially in Perth. Like TEDx Sydney is huge. I think everyone in the eastern states was already on the bandwagon a lot more than us here in the west. So they only had TEDx Perth at the time. So I think seeing another TEDx in WA on the socials was really exciting to them. So it was like, oh my gosh, this blew up. We've got to disappoint like literally 80% of the people because we can only fit 120. But even the process of finding speakers was interesting. Everybody, including myself, exponentially like went on a huge learning curve of even just how to write an email. Most of us were like, I mean, except me, obviously, because I was like a final year student, but most of us were like freshers or second year students who kind of just wrote like emails very minimally in their day-to-day activities to learning how to, you know, write a really sleek professional email, getting those speakers involved. But I think it really helped having the TED brand to be like, hi, I'm from TED. And they'd be like, instant reply. I think it sort of increased our likelihood of getting a response, which was great. One of the biggest enjoyments of doing events like this is to see people grow. So I think by the end of that year, all of us grew in skills, soft and sort of, you know, more technical skills. All of us grew in character. All of us probably got a lot more tired at the end of it, but we learned so much. We also really enjoy getting what we call wildcard speakers. So speakers that, let's be real, are a bit of like a celebrity in their own right. And we do kind of promote them to increase ticket sales, although that wasn't an issue the first year. But we also want to bring them in because we know that they're known for a certain side to them in the public eye, but we want them on our stage to show a different side of them. And it was very fitting because our very first conference theme was changing perceptions. So that was what we were trying to target. We also wanted to change the perceptions of youth-led operations, youth-led organizations, and show that we can also be really successful in what we do. I was just literally on like watching Australia's Got Talent or something. And I had Sukhjit Kolkata, who's this amazing spoken word poet. I was just so inspired by her. But after quick Googling, I found that she was actually from Perth. But at the time, I think she was based in Melbourne. And I was just like, what are the odds? But you know what? The worst thing that I'll get is a no. So I just emailed her and she said, oh, I'm in LA at the moment, but I'll make it work. It was just really interesting that our first wildcard speaker happened to be, you know, this, you know, Australian's Got Talent contestant, but also amazing superwoman in her own right. So it was really great to increase our confidence in that sense as well and grow our network.
That's a great first TEDxUWA story. Still going on now?
Yeah, still going strong. We are probably in our 7th or 8th year of operations now. It's really crazy to think that that much time has flown by.
There's a lot of people coming through the door, a lot of people on stage. Maybe not best to start it in your final year of studies,
yeah.
But you made it work. You graduate UWA in 2017, and then, you know, this little thing called Forbes 30 Under 30 happens. Tell me what was happening with the summit in Boston and what you were named as part of.
A lot of people know the Forbes Under 30 list. I did not formally make that list in a traditional sense, but I think through the networks that I found through exchange, so I went to China and the United States for exchange, and I think it was more on the United States front that I heard about these great programs that Forbes Under 30 was running, which includes the Forbes Under 30 Scholars. It's not so much an Under 30 list of accolades like its traditional sense, but it's an opportunity for students to apply to show their passions and interests in world peace and environment, things like that. But basically, it's an opportunity for young people to get access to the Forbes Under 30 Summit, which that year was held in Boston. So I applied with a couple of my other mates in the US as well, and we were very lucky that a bunch of us got in. So we got all expenses paid trip to meet, you know, and congregate in Boston for a couple of days in October of 2017. And that was really great because, again, matching the ethos of TEDxUWA, it's all about giving an opportunity for young people to be part of these great events and functions and conversations. And while it's just the start of something, you know, we need to acknowledge that there's so many other amazing young change makers out there that should get these equal opportunities as well. But it was fantastic. I think we got to speak to the guy that invented the Segway. I'm a huge fan of ASAP Science and their YouTube content. And we just got to see them live and, you know, perform their normal skits, but also tell the story behind why and how they started ASAP Science. Meeting Carly Kloss and learning her journey of why she started coding with Carly and why that's really important in empowering young girls in that space, but also juggling, you know, her modeling and all her other work. But the biggest highlight for me was seeing Kendrick Lamar. That was a really big deal.
Is this where you announce your rap career?
No. Rap is, I think, the only creative avenue that I have yet to tap into. So work in progress. Stay tuned.
At TEDxUWA 2023. That's very exciting. Yeah. The only Australian in attendance as well to that. So a huge congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
What's it like to be one of those people who are invited in to the ground level? You created it yourself with TEDxUWA, but to be invited into things like the summit in Boston, right where those moments and those sparks of inspiration happen, that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, I think it's those events that you really sort of, you know, you kind of have to be a little bit out of your comfort zone, right? I am very much aligned to the whole extroverted introverted type. I tend to, you know, be a little bit more closed in, especially when it comes to like business style networking events. So I think that was my first plunge into, I got to really push myself to get out of my comfort zone and start talking to all these strangers, because there is going to be a huge benefit in at least just having a LinkedIn connection with them. And it is, because I'm still connected with, I think, like a good handful of the people that I met there. They either became my mentors or even my handy helpers when it comes to my work today, because some of them are really brilliant scientists as well. But you never know what future ripple effects that you can create from just saying a quick hello or having a quick coffee catch up in these kinds of events, because it is all about bringing like-minded people together. And whether you're not, you might not be in the same sector or the same industry, but all of the people there share that collective drive and energy to make positive change and to make things happen and go.
And as we know, these events and behind closed doors, that's where all these things and these big changes actually get to happen.
Mm.
So it's super important that more and more young people are being invited into that space and given the soapbox for 15 minutes or whatever it might be, as important as it is doing it in the classroom and taking it to young people. We talked about Millennium Kids earlier because you got to experience firsthand how exciting it was to be a part of that and to see change unfold in real time. You've come back to them in your adult life. Tell us what your involvement with Millennium Kids is now.
I think it's definitely paying it forward, because I think even though at the time I felt that it was just like, oh, this is cool, you know, this adult thought that my e-newsletter idea was great so I could pitch it and it's now a reality. But I think looking back now, that was such a pivotal moment in my life that caused a huge impact in me. And again, you know, it helped me build confidence. It helped me build a stronger sort of self-esteem and stronger sort of, I guess, belief in myself, that I want, you know, more young people to feel the same way too. People who may have been, you know, or who are still going through the same things that I went through or similar, or just being that fish out of water or that outsider. I want them to feel empowered and know that they're not alone in their struggles and that they too will be heard and should be heard. And I want to be a mentor to them to say, hey, I've kind of been in your shoes before. I was literally sitting, you know, at that very table when I was in year five with my own little idea, thinking that I can't make big change. But someone put faith in me. Someone, you know, gave me a shot and, you know, I took it. Doors and windows and everything opened as a result of that. I really enjoy and I get a kick out of working and being with young people. It sounds like I'm a vampire, but it's just like sort of sucking the energy out of them is actually really great for me as well, because sometimes I could just feel like I'm stuck in a rut with work or with anything. You know, I could be facing like personal challenges and things like that, and just being able to just chat with young people, getting a fresh perspective, something that's maybe a little bit unconventional, can be really refreshing and quite therapeutic as well, actually.
We talked just about being in Boston and how being at those moments and those sparks of inspiration, as much as it is with the big movers and shakers, it is with young people as well, right?
Exactly.
As part of your work with Millennium Kids, you led the Willy Wagtail Project. Mm. What is that?
So the Willy Wagtail Project is sort of an offshoot of Millennium Kids. So Millennium Kids is just like a huge collective that supports young people in all the projects that they do, trying to mentor them to sort of put a bit more of a realistic lens for any of our more audacious projects to ensure that it is either viable or feasible or even able to be commercialized or realized into something further. So the Willy Wagtail Project just stemmed out of a couple of our members who were really interested in the concept of upcycling as a force for change and as something that they could also turn into actual products that can continue the story of the benefits of upcycling or the benefits of, you know, a world without waste. We decided to create that in memory, actually, of a Millennium Kid who passed away, unfortunately. Her name's Pippa, who used to absolutely love Willy Wagtails, or Chitty Chitties, as they're called, in Noongar. And they're called Chitty Chitties because they're supposed to, that they're known to be sort of spreading gossip, or they like to sort of, you know, just spread news around the country. And so we want to use that ethos and spread the good vibes of being more sustainable and being more green and being more conscious about our consumption and our wastage. We decided to take on a lot of young people's ideas in terms of, let's just work with textile companies or fashion companies or even food packaging companies that have a lot of wastage, whether it be plastic or textiles or other materials, and start creating products out of them, because our young people are just really excited in getting going in that space. Our young people have made bags, like handbags, clothes, wallets, stubby holders, all the things under the sun that they've designed, sourced materials for, and just created by themselves. And they would sell it at upmarkets, summer ex-salt markets in Scarborough, and a lot of other places. But these products have a story to tell as well. So the young people even go to the lengths of putting on their brand and marketing hats and getting fashion tags and making sure that each product tells the story of who created it, why it was created, and what impact the person who bought it will make to the community. So it's been really cool to see that happen. We're still having some presence in a couple of stores, and we'll continue to branch that to future projects.
I love this. Some people have picked up what it is that you're putting down with the Willy Wagtail Project. Mm. Because in 2020, it was recognised by the Australian ASEAN Council and Australian Government Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, also known as DFAT, as one of Australia and ASEAN's top 20 social enterprises. That is a huge title. What was it like breaking that to the team?
It was really cool. But shortly before that, we also won the WA Youth Award. I think it was sort of run out of Yakwa I don't exactly remember the award, but it was just like Best Community Group or something. And then that was awarded to Millennium Kids and the Willy Wagtail Project, which was really, really exciting. And then it was just, you know, icing on the cake, basically. We were just on a roll to break the news to the team that it was also recognised in a more sort of, you know, social enterprise lens, but also in a potential foreign affairs, sort of foreign diplomacy lens as well. Because what we were doing, and it was a collective between the efforts of Millennium Kids, but also the Willy Wagtail Project, is we started tapping into collaboration internationally. It was a combination of my background and some networks that the Millennium Kids team had, and also because I just really wanted to, we were discussing earlier about finding a sense of identity back at high school, and I think now this was already, you know, during my uni days where I started to really finally accept and appreciate myself and my background. And I think I finally was at peace in not fighting the urge to be more Australian or be more Indonesian anymore, but rather embracing that duality. And I literally have the best of both worlds, that Hannah Montana song, ringing in my head every time I think about it, because it literally is, you know, it's like, while it was a struggle at the beginning, I look back now very fondly because all those experiences, the hardships and the successes, really shaped me to be in a position of great advantage, that I have that duality of perspectives. Leveraging a lot of my networks and background with Indonesia, we were able to secure some really great partnerships with our fellow youth empowering environmental organizations in Indonesia as well. We did a lot of collaborations, and this was pre-COVID. We did a lot of trips and exchanges where young people from both Indonesia and Australia could gather in respective places, meet, and just even share learnings, sort of discussing climate and sustainability issues that we're facing here in Perth are the same in Jakarta or Sumbawa or other places of Indonesia, and how we, you know, are respectively tackling it. It's been fantastic that DFAT was able to acknowledge that as an opportunity for essentially strengthening geographic and really, in a sense, strategic ties from our young people. And it doesn't have to just be the adults that make that change, but young people can also really build that from the ground up.
Many of your awards are in acknowledgement of your contribution to the community and to really having young people lead initiatives, like with the Willy Wagtail Project and all the other work at Millennium Kids. You've also been awarded many other things. We've already mentioned the 30 Under 30 Summit, the Youth Community Citizen Award, and the Premier's Australia Day Active Citizenship Award, just to name a few. I'm sure there's more from high school as well. What is it about the issue of empowering young people that keeps you so passionate? Because most of these awards have stemmed from your commitment to that work.
Mm. I think it goes back to what I said earlier. I just love working and being around young people. I think the energy that they give off is infectious. I love the sense that young people are not restricted by boundaries yet, you know. I think they have yet to be placed that those restrictions, or be, I guess, get that reality check. So I really want to tap into them, and again, it sounds like a vampire, but I just really want to suck that energy, you know, or just tap into that while they're still very audacious, very innovative, and very creative, because some of those out-of-the-box ideas are what we actually need, or some of those out-of-the-box ideas should be the catalyst to identifying actual meaningful and the best solutions in the end. I just love being around them and empowering them and giving them that mentorship and guidance, but in a minimal sense, because I think these young people, you know, I'm saying these young people because unfortunately within my formal age bracket, I'm about to not be a young person anymore, which is a bit tragic.
They're going to boot you out.
I know. I want to instill in them the confidence that they should just spread their wings and fly, as cheesy as that sounds, because they will understand that the harsh reality is going to impose on them some restrictions and boundaries and limits. But before they get to that stage, they need to also fully embrace just being, you know, just sort of thinking and problem solving as if there were no boundaries and there were no limits.
I'm sure by this point your email inbox is just full of requests to come and speak at this thing and accept an award for this thing. So you wouldn't be mistaken for missing one or two. I want to talk about the moment that you found out you'd been nominated and then inducted into the West Australian Women's Hall of Fame. Do you remember what that was like?
So I don't get that many emails and announcements for awards. Again, I'm really more of a behind-the-scenes type person. I just do it because I really enjoy it. I think a common thread between a lot of leaders like myself. We just do it because we get a huge kick out of it. We obviously don't do it with the intent of having an award in mind. It's like, oh, I want to get this award and I have to work backwards, therefore I have to do this kind of thing. That's a bit of a, you know, strange attitude to get about it. But yeah, I just love doing what I do. I am also quite an expressive person. I've been told that I do spread good vibes and cause that ripple effect, which is a subconscious but nice side effect to have. I want to be able to create safe spaces with the people I work with and ensure that everyone does have a seat in the table to truly be heard and feel comfortable and safe in sharing their ideas and inputs, whether it's going to be leading to a debate or even an argument, but I think that's still really meaningful to have those conversations heard. I think a lot of people do know that I am very much a rather do the things because I like it rather than, you know, just going to helm the ship or represent everyone and getting these awards. So a lot of people nominate me for things for the fun of it because they know that I don't like the attention. And it sounds really weird, but yes, I'm absolutely so grateful for it, truly humbled. But I think they'd partially do it probably because, you know, it's worth a shot, but they also do it because it's like a joke. They just want to troll me, I think, because I do get those emails, like you said, I do get those emails occasionally, but I don't know where they came from. And that's the whole joke. So I think I'll just be like in the group chat saying, okay, guys, like, who did this now? I didn't get an email that I was nominated, I think. I got a call from the Women's Hall of Fame notifying me that I got inducted. And I do remember that point because I was literally in the city in a not so great mood and I was forcing myself to leave the office to go to Zara because they were on sale and I just wanted to have retail therapy. So I was on my way to Zara in a bit of a huffy mood when I got a phone call. And normally it's one of those days where I wouldn't pick up. But again, fate, right? Like, I just felt I had to pick up. So they called me and then so they told me that, oh, you've been nominated and you have been selected to be inducted. And I was just like, hold the phone, like, stop it. Like, this is like another cruel joke. Like, who did this? Because I think we needed to like backtrack. It's like, wait, I was even nominated in the first place. So there I was, this sort of, you know, short little Asian girl, literally in a fetal position in the corner of a Zara rack because I was just trying to digest everything that just happened in a matter of seconds. It was really funny that I actually took a photo of like my feet, like just being squashed in a rack in Zara, just because it's like I was already at the shop and then all these news hit me really hard. It's like just a huge mix of emotions that I just needed to sit down. There was no place to sit in Zara at the time. And I think the sales rep just came up to me. I'm just like, are you okay? I was like, yeah, I'm fine. It came as a huge shock, but it was really exciting. I actually didn't know about the WA Women's Hall of Fame prior to that, so I did a lot of Googling afterwards. Again, imposter syndrome, because I'm a really big advocate of, like, I would wish there was some way to make these awards recognize teams rather than individual people, because I think it's great that we do have these awards, but we also need to really acknowledge that it is a huge team effort and there's a huge movement of people that probably helped build this one individual to who they are today. I mean, I'm still reeling about it to this point. What happened? What a year. But yeah.
It's a good thing you're at Zara, really, because you could start shopping for an acceptance award dress.
Yeah.
When you hung the phone up and eventually pulled yourself out of the clothing rack, Who was the first person you called to tell?
I called my mum. Mum's definitely a huge role model to me, especially she's like a female role model to me. She's like a superwoman. I definitely owe a lot of things to her and to her sacrifices, also to my dad. But I think in this case, Mum is such a champion. She definitely faced a lot of adversary and challenges to be able to raise her kids in the environment that we are in today. And I think I would not be able to have all these opportunities and be able to do all the things that I am doing and that I did without her support and help.
Yeah, you can't be what you can't see. And
exactly.
Your mum was that for you.
Yeah, for sure.
Before we wrap up, Thea, I just want to ask about now, what is it that's keeping you busy these days?
mainly work. I'm doing a lot of work in also the environmental space, which I absolutely love, and really bringing in my engineering knowledge as well, which is great. It's a fantastic return on investment on all the money that my parents spent, all the money I've spent. So it's fantastic to be able to finally use my degree. Yeah, doing a lot of work in the green energy, green infrastructure space, which is really exciting. Very new, very interesting phase where things are not yet concrete in terms of what it actually means to our society. But I really enjoy being in the forefront of this new science and being able to help our clients, you know, and guide them to make more socially conscious and environmentally conscious decisions.
Yeah. I love that you're charging ahead into uncharted territory yet again, but you sound really excited to be doing it.
Yeah, it's absolutely, like, again, another kick out of me. And I still to this day ask a lot of young people for their suggestions because I'm currently writing up a huge report on green concrete and what that actually means. And I literally just surveyed it to a bunch of young kids to be like, hey, if you hear the term green concrete, what does that mean to you? Does that mean concrete that is green in colour, or does that mean concrete that is environmentally friendly? And to what extent is it environmentally friendly? Is it reducing carbon emissions? Is it being created out of recycled products? That kind of thing. So that brainstorm session actually spun out a lot of ideas that is actually benefiting my research paper, but also, you know, future client projects. These kids, you know, we've got to empower them and we've got to continue supporting them because they are the change. Yeah.
If in doubt, ask a kid.
Exactly.
All right. Thea Koniawan, thank you so much for your time and congratulations on your induction.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to Thea Koniawan and all the women at the WA Women's Hall of Fame. And as always, every week, thank you to the women who make Her Story happen. Our executive producer is Danae Gibson. Our assistant producers are Sophie Minisale and Madeline Lombardi. Emily Jane Reid is our production assistant. Artwork courtesy of Peter Roebuck and theme music and original composition from Annika Moses. Her Story is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. This podcast was produced on Whadjuk Noongarrbuja. RTRFM acknowledges and pays respect to the Aboriginal elders of this land, past and present. These lands were never ceded. My name's Taylor Strano. Next week, we'll meet one of Australia's most prolific researchers and commentators on Muslim identities.